I'm Christopher Lydon in Tunisia with the first draft history of the great Arab event that began here 2 years ago. Call it the spring, the revolt, the upheaval, as you will. Our guest, the radio reporter Farida Ayari, who covered it all, asked me, what revolution? The revolution, she says, is still to come. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. My co-host here and my fellow traveler in North Africa is the podcaster Mark Fonseca Rendiro from Amsterdam and from New Jersey before that. His blog is citizenreporter.org. Farida Ayari, you've seen and done it all for French radio. Africa, South Africa, the Mediterranean, Middle East, North Africa. Can we put the revolution that began in Tunisia in perspective yet?
In Tunisia, what happened, it's a rebellion. A rebellion of the poor against a system of power which was based on repression with a very strong political police and based on corruption, with two families, the family of Ben Ali's wife and the family of Ben Ali himself, who put the grab on the Tunisian economy. This rebellion is also a result of the disparities between the coastal part of the country and the inland country. The development was emphasized on the coast with the development of tourism, etc. And the inland country was left alone, though they were providing the most important wealth of Tunisia, the phosphate in the south and southwest and east, and agriculture in the north. It is not amazing that the Arab Spring started in Tunisia, because since the 19th century, Tunisia was one of the most reformist country in terms of modernity and introduction of modern values of human rights, education, moderate Islam, which we could qualify as a quiet Islam, you know. It is because we were in advance comparing to the other Arab countries, including Egypt, which is one of the most important by the population and the strategic position, etc. So that's why it's not amazing that it started all here. This rebellion again, I mean, we are using revolution, rebellion. For me, it's more a rebellion.
I mean, Malouf calls it an upheaval.
I think the revolution has still to come.
Interesting.
Yes. The revolution has still to come, because the revolution is about what? The revolution is about the transformation of a society, of the mentalities, of the organization of the state and of its structures. And this has not been done yet. It has still to come. The rebellion was about freedom, about bread, about jobs, and about dignity. I think all these slogans were slogans based on modern values, values that are universal and anchored in the 21st century. What the revolution or the rebellion revealed? It revealed two things, basically. First of all, that despite that reformism I mentioned starting in the 19th century under the Prime Minister Khairuddin Pasha, despite the modernism and secularism then imposed by Habib Bourguiba, the first president, despite the code of personal status, who gave almost, I would not say all, equality between men and women, but almost equality between men and women, the rebellion revealed that Tunisia was still a very conservative society. During all these years, since the independence in 1956, people were actually deprived of practicing their religion, because very soon, beginning of the 70s, Islamist movement appeared against this secularism imposed by the government. And because it was a political movement, it has been repressed, as the previous regime, including Bourguiba regime, repressed as well the left, the extreme left, and the rightists, which are the Islamists. People felt they were deprived of practicing their religion, because under, especially with, during the last 10 years under Ben Ali, if you go often to the mosque, you would be suspected.
What was the pretext of making worship illegal?
We must be clear here. Worship, of course, was not illegal or banned, but as political movement appeared, especially soon after the Iranian Revolution in 1979, the regime in Tunisia started by banning political parties who had as reference Islam. That's why the movement of Islamic tendency, which is the original name of a Nahda, became a Nahda, which means a renaissance. Mm. So all the appearance, you know, the dress code, the bears, all this became suspicious, you know. And but you cannot say that worship was banned or illegal. It was, what was illegal is to do politics on the base of Islam, of religion.
Farida, explain the paradox that in Tunisia, as in Egypt, the revolutionaries toppled the system, but the Islamists made the new government.
Yes, it's it is easily explainable, because, as I told you, people felt deprived of worshipping and practicing their religion. Then what appeared also with the revolution is that we were thinking that the Tunisian people were very well educated. And it was a mistake. Actually, inside the country, the real population, the masses, are not well educated, and they don't have a clue about the values of democracy. So when you have an Islamist from another campaigning on the basis of the Quran and religion, saying that if they worship, all their problem will be solved, that our identity is Islamic, and that we are Arab, which is not true, because the majority of the people in Tunisia are Berber and not Arab. The Arab are invaders, like any invaders that Tunisia known since the ancient time, you know?
Like the Romans.
Like the, yeah, the Romans, the Turkish, the French. And then you take, let's say, a secular politician, which try to campaign on modern values and democracy, they will not understand. And I recently spoke with the leader of Al-Jumhuri Party, who lost the elections. And he told me, we didn't have any practice of democracy. Our only reference for democracy were European. And we campaigned the same way. We campaigned calling the brain of the Tunisian and not the heart. And we told them, our problems are ahead of us. We need to reconciliate. We need to rehabilitate the police, etc. And the people didn't understand this message, which is the, it's common sense. Yes, it's true. We have to reconciliate this country. We have to rehabilitate the police, which was the arm of the repression during the Ancien regime. So he said democracy. I thought it was a natural concept. But in fact, people have not a clue about democracy. So the political speech based on religion was received 5-on-5 by the people. And the democratic speech about value, universal rights, etc., was not understood by the people. That's why they vote for Renata. My aide at home, I asked her a few days before 23rd October election, for whom are you going to vote? And she said, for Renata. And I said, why? She said, because there is a lot of corruption in the country, and they are believers, so they will be good, and, they will fight corruption, etc. But now people are realizing that Renata is as much corrupt as any other politicians. If you see that the Minister of Foreign Affairs is the son-in-law of Mr. Rashid Ghannouchi, another leader, you realize that now they are setting up companies and they are using state funds for their own benefits. Finally, and this is striking, they are reproducing what was done by the previous regime, and they are using exactly the same method.
So what does your maid say today?
Today she is very disappointed, like I think many, many other Tunisian people, because they realized that their personal situation didn't improve at all. I mean, unemployment doubled since the revolution. At the moment of, in December 2010, Tunisia had 400,000 unemployed. Today, Tunisia had nearly 1 million unemployed.
So where are we? We have a popular revolution. It's successful. It's contagious throughout the Arab world. And yet you say the right wing has taken over the country. Mm-hmm. What's the score? If this were a football game, what would the score be?
My dear Christopher, I know nothing about football, so I cannot make comparison with football.
Who's winning?
For the moment, it's the reactionary forces who are winning, meaning Ennahda, and of course, the extremists, which are the Salafists. For example, a lot of mistakes were made during the transitional period. And actually, Ennahda is playing a tricky game that could soon be very negative for him. Because they allowed the Salafists to move freely in the country, to do their proselytism, and even Abu Iyad himself, when I met him last March 2012, he thanked Ennahda, saying thanks to Ennahda, because now we can move and work freely. But Ennahda must be careful, because if they won the elections, It is because we campaign for them. On the other side, Anoushi said to me last February, Nahda are like my children, they remind me my youth. So there is a jeu de rôle, a role-playing game between a Nahda and the Salafist. And the danger is that if a Nahda lose the next election, Tunisia could fall into violence because there is a lot of weapons and guns inside the country, especially since what happened in Libya. You know, the borders are not under control anymore. There is probably one or two training camps for jihadists on the Algerian-Tunisian border. And so problems are ahead of us, and I hope that this country will not fall really into violence.
Meantime, the left wing is also free and seems very assured and open about its criticism and it's about its agitation. Doesn't that count, too, as a gain for the revolution?
The left. First of all, we don't have only the left. Now, in Tunisia, we are talking about the modernist on the one side and the conservative on the other side. Of course, the conservatives are another and their friends. The modernist goes from the center, center-right, to center-left, to left and extreme left. Now you have two major modernist front. I would say the center-right front is made of Nida Tunis, the movement launched by the former Prime Minister Beji Caid Sepsi last July, Al-Jumhuri Party of Ahmed Najib Shebi, and Al-Masar, which gather what used to be communist, but now they are more center-left than communist, and the Social Democrats. And then you have the People's Front, Le Front Populaire in French, led by Hama Hamemi, who is the leader of the Workers' Party. And despite the fact that we cannot compare, he's a kind of little Mandela for Tunisia because he spent half of his life in prison and the second half in clandestinely, in hiding. He's very, very popular among the youth. He's very well installed inside the country because he comes from the northwest. And for the people, he is perceived as a genuine politician that cares about the real problem, which are bread. And he told me, I interviewed him last month, and he told me, when I go inland, I travel in the region, people tell me, we love you, Hama. But we love also Nahda, because Nahda, it's about freedom, bread and religion. But you, it's only about bread and freedom. He's an atheist, and he's not compromising with that, you know. He is telling the truth to the people. So that's why people are telling him, if you say the Shahada, La ilaha illallah wa Muhammad Rasulullah, we will vote for you. But he doesn't want to do that compromise, you know. Yeah. On the other side, Nida Tunis, they think that by saying that they are not against the religion, Beji Caid Sepsi, who is a very old man, he will be on 29 November, 86 years old, is telling me, did you notice that I start every speech with Quran verses? I said, yes, I noticed, but is it really useful? If we want to set up a real democracy, the most important thing, the pillar, is to divide politics from religion. Politics is one thing. Religion is a spiritual thing and a personal thing. every individual has the right to believe or not believe, but it is between him and his faith, not about public demonstration of your faith or for your worshipness, etc.
Do you suppose, Farida, that Tunisia is still a kind of miniature of the whole Arab Spring and maybe the Arab future in the sense of a hungry population, a modern tendency, but also a very well-organized Islamist political base? Is that the story to this point? And when comes the real revolution?
I think that the real revolution will come after the election. It depends on the outcome of 2013 elections.
Here. Or everywhere?
Here. Let's talk about Tunisia. I don't think that Tunisia is a miniature of the Arab world. We are very specific. We are even very specific comparing to Algeria, our big neighbor, or Morocco, because since the ancient time, this little tiny country been confronted to other civilization. And in 1990, I wrote a book, and the first sentence was, I will translate from French, Tunisia is like an Oriental woman absorbing all the invaders. We absorbed all the invaders, we digest them, we took the best of them, and we are still here, and we are a condensate of all these influences. You don't find this in Algeria, you don't find this in Egypt. It's very, very different. I cannot say that we are a miniature, that maybe we are a laboratory. If we succeed to set up a genuine democracy which will be reconciled with a moderate Islam, which would be considered as a personal thing for each person, with the liberty to worship or not worship, and if we install the democratic values, an economic system that will be distributing equally wealth among the people, among the region, with no more disparities, then I will say yes. If we succeed, then the whole Arab world will succeed. If we fail, it is finished for the Arab world for many, many years, for many decades.
Why?
Because you will have a fundamentalist wave from Tangier to Tehran and forget democracy. My main grief about the modernists is that they are not working enough on a speech which would be understood by average people and poor people about democratic values. They are using concepts from the West without trying to apply them to our particularities, to our cultural traditions, etc., etc. I'm sure there is a way to create a genuine democracy. I don't see why Muslim people will not be able to live in democracies.
What if people around the world want fundamentalism, including in the United States, as well as Iran, as well as in Israel, as well as in all sorts of places, as well as maybe somewhere in the human heart?
You know, André Malraux said long, long time ago that the 21st century will be spiritual or will not be. I don't know if you remember that, but he said so. There is all around the world a reawakening of religion and spiritualism, and indeed fundamentalism exists everywhere. We have seen it in the United States with the Bush policy. We are seeing it in Europe with all these conservative Catholic Christians party, of course in Israel and everywhere else. From my point of view, the main mistake of the United States foreign affairs policy was to believe in moderate Islamism. It can't be a moderate movement. The Islamism in the Muslim and Arab world is just the expression of an extreme right conservatism in reaction of the modern value of democracy that were brought in the Middle East and in North Africa by the British and by the French, and also the expression of the failure of the Pan-Arabism, where when Nasser was the anchor of this Pan-Arabism and this will to unite all the Arabs from the Atlantic to the Gulf. He failed, and in the same time, the Gulf country rose with the oil wealth. And I cannot accept that Saudi Arabia, which is the country practicing the most rigorous Islam with the Wahhabism, is the main partner of the United States. Because Wahhabism is the roots of Salafism. These people want to practice Islam like it was practiced in the 7th century under Prophet Muhammad, and they accept to use the technologies, but in terms of personal life of people, they are not allowing any freedom. I mean, when you think that in Saudi Arabia a woman cannot drive a car, I mean, this is middle age.
So you're calling up the nightmare of George Bush holding hands with the King of Saudi Arabia?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. 9/11 was a catastrophe for the Muslims and the Arabs. And Osama bin Laden is a creation of the United States. Yes, because when Russia invaded Afghanistan, the states armed the Mujahideen to fight the Russians, but actually all these guys were fundamentalists. Charlie Wilson, a congressman from Texas, who convinced the Congress to help the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, is at the roots of the Taliban's, and satellites of the Taliban's were Osama bin Laden and his gang, and then started this young men from all over the Arab and Muslim world pouring into Afghanistan to make jihad, etc. So Washington got it wrong since the beginning.
Washington has a new chance with a new President Obama. What's your advice?
Well, I will advise Obama to stop considering that there is moderate Islamist politicians. I would advise him to spread the ideas that religion has nothing to do with the political system of a country or the economic system of a country, that those two things must be separate. Everyone should be free to live as he wanted and not compromise with religious leaders.
But President Obama said almost exactly that in 2009 in the famous Cairo speech. He said, I do have an unyielding belief that all people yearn for certain things, including the ability to speak your mind and have a say in how you are governed, and finally, the freedom to live as you choose. Does he need to say it again? Should he go back to Cairo?
Maybe there is no need to go back to Cairo, but and I don't think today it would be possible for him to go to Cairo with the new regime set in Cairo. You know, a Muslim Brotherhood is in power, the President Morsi. Salafists are already into parliament.
But they won the election. But they won their elections.
Yeah, they won the elections, but the matter is, should we authorize political parties where the fundamentals are religion? I don't think so. I mean, really, my belief is that religion must be separated from politics, and we should not allow, yes, you will tell me that in Europe, up to now, there is Democrat-Christian parties. But they have evaluated quite a lot since they appeared mainly after Second World War. Again, no. I don't think that Muslim Brotherhood or whatever Islamist movement should base its principles on religion.
But even in the United States, certainly since Jimmy Carter, presidential candidates have campaigned on their Christianity or their religious values. Mm-hmm. Who are we to say that the people can't choose what they choose?
Yeah, I know in the United States, the president take oath on the Bible.
Yeah,
it's true. They can still here take oath on the Quran, I don't mind, but the principle of the religion must not guide our everyday life.
I mean, certainly not one rule of religion for everybody.
Certainly not, yes. What should be one of the main objectives of this new government and the coming government that will come out of the 2013 election is to reduce these disparities, you know, to redistribute the wealth more equitably between the people, to set up infrastructures in those inland countries. You know, I went to Jenduba early last month to do a story about women. I broke my car because the road was so bad that I fall in a hole and I broke my car, and it cost me 600 dinar to fix it. When I go to Sfax, I don't break my car. I mean, it's a highway all along, you know. This gives you an idea of these two Tunisia, and that's why the rebellion started in those areas, you know.
Mark Rendiro, a.k.a. Bicycle Mark, over to you.
You've pointed to education. It comes up a lot when you talk about the problems of Tunisia and the future, the questions about the future, education. Is there a huge disparity in education in these two Tunisias?
There is a lot of disparities in education. For example, When I was in Siliana Makhtar last March, I visited the primary school. I met a teacher, I met the head teacher, and he told me, I want to show you my school. Nice little school. They put latrines, they built latrines in the school during the 80s, but up to today, there is no water connected to latrines. And his budget is 20 dinars per month to maintain his school. 20 dinars makes 10 euros, $15, you know. So how can you educate little kids properly with so little means, you know? Secondly, I think that one of the priorities should be a reform of education. Because soon after independence, in the first budget of the Republic of Tunisia, 30% of the budget went to education. I found that extraordinary. Today, in most of the countries, 30% of the budget goes to defense, not to education. I am the product of that education policy because I am the first generation, I am among the first generation, educated soon after independence. In 1975, they did the first reform of Arabization, you know? Because we've been studying everything in French with literature course in Arabic, civic education in Arabic, because it was civic and religious education in Arabic, and all the rest was taught in French. Suddenly they decided that they will teach everything in Arabic, but they didn't have the skills for that. Not enough teachers trained to teach science, mathematics, history, geography in Arabic. And then, after the Ben Ali coup d'etat against Bourguiba, there was another reform of education that time to empty education from all the modern values. For example, in the philosophy courses, the big questions about from where we come from, etc., all the existentialist questions were all withdrawn from the program. So they fabricated years after years, yes, graduate young people, but not prepared to face the real life and the working life. Today, yes, they say there is maybe 250,000 young graduates without job, but if you hire one of them today, you have to train him from the beginning to be able to make a good worker in whatever field it is, huh? So education is a huge, huge problem, and the danger is that we are now seeing the development of Quranic schools where you see little girls as little as 5 years old already wearing a veil, like I saw in Afghanistan. All the little girls in Afghanistan are wearing a veil, a white veil. And this is developing now in Tunisia.
Farida Ayari, it's a great pleasure to get what we call the short course from Tunisia. And we will pursue all of your leads. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
This conversation with Farida Ayari was produced and edited by Mark Fonseca Rendiro. Special thanks to the photographer Sophia Barraquet, who introduced us to Farida. This is part of our series On the Road Heading Toward Cairo and Beirut. We're calling it Arab Artists in a Revolution. And we're counting on your feedback in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. www.arabnetwork.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining us on the journey.